Okay, Jim McGonigal, thanks very much for coming in to talk about Passage today. This was published in the past week or so.
Yes.
It was launched at the Scottish Poetry Library.
Last week. And yes, Hamish, usually Brit brings things not hot off the press, but wet off the press. and if you're lucky, you get one where the ink has dried. Uh-huh. So, no, it was fine. Yeah, during summer, I think. And it's a production of poets, really, in the sense that Jerry Cambridge, the poet, he did the typesetting, and Joe Murray, also a poet, he did the cover design, which is very good.
It is. It's Paddy's Milestone.
Yes, that's right. Or, as Edwin Morgan said, Paddy's Hump. I'd never heard that before.
I've never heard that. That must be a Glasgow one.
Yes, and seemed to be quite sectarian too. About the sort of dishevelled, crippled Irish, as they were. But yeah, this must be a Glasgow one. I've never heard it.
Paddy's Hump.
Paddy's Hump. It's horrible.
Yes, it is. I prefer Paddy's Milestone.
Milestone is better, yeah. Aye. Yes. And actually, funnily enough, I passed it, and the night I had to give the first reading of this, because it was part of it was my entry into a long poem competition, yeah. And the winner was to be announced at the Scottish Central Scottish Library. What's it called? The one in Edinburgh.
The Scottish
National Library.
The National Library of Scotland.
Yeah.
Right.
So I was on holiday in Ireland, so I had to kind of come back for that event and passed Paddy's Milestone. So it was very nice.
That's nice. Yeah.
Yes, it was. It was good.
How long have you been working on it? I mean, it is a long poem.
Yes, I would say for quite a long while, as part of coming to terms with different aspects of my ancestry and heritage, which includes a language heritage as well, or a lost heritage in this case. Mm-hmm. So I would say probably over about 6 to 8 years, bits of it were building in until there was the occasion of that competition.
Yeah.
And it's made up of various kinds of aspects of Scots-Irish history, Irish immigrant history in Scotland, and family history, and language history as well, in the various languages, personal language history from my own background, and also languages that I'd learned and studied at school and since, and translations that had been made of my work and so on. So there was a whole aspect of that.
Did you always have a long poem in mind when you started off? Or a sequence of poems?
More sequences. And in fact, just in the kind of spurious way that poets do, you make things of, you make something of bits of fragments that are lying around. I mean, essentially, the passage north to Armagh, which is the third of the big long passages, that was a reworking of something that I wrote quite a long time ago, and I changed the form a bit and I tightened it up and disciplined it a little bit. But yes, that's something from about 5 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And then some of the poems, which are separate at the end, it's a kind of epic structure. Mm-hmm. Which then, as it nears the present, begins to fragment a little bit into perceptions, rather like the sense of culture or Irishness begins to alter once the people come to Scotland. And then the ability to make a large statement or to be part of a culture actually breaks down into separate little poems. But they're two fro poems, but some set in Scotland and Glasgow, some set in Northern Ireland, in Ballycastle mainly, but also other parts. In fact, in Donegal, Glencolumbkill is where the last bit of the poem is headed, where, of course, Columba left from. It's the Glen of St. Columba, one of the places where he had left Ireland on the way to Iona. Mm-hmm. So, there's the sense of that voyage starting out again at the very end. But, of course, it's also a poem about dying and just the sense of easing into another sort of water at the end reasonably sort of hopeful or relaxed or exhausted way. I always tell a story about where that poem came from. This is
which one is it?
It's the very final one.
Okay.
Regarding water, it's my money-making poem, the one that made
the one that won the prize,
and the one that won two prizes. I'm ashamed to say it won a prize in already in Ireland as part of the Dufferin Hanna Award, and so it made money there, and then I shoved it in again at the end of this, and it's a kind of clinching thing. Mm-hmm. But it arises from a time when I was absolutely exhausted by the kind of treadmill approach to working, which I tend to adopt probably from a peasant ancestry, just getting harnessed up and going on until I collapsed. And this was an Easter time when I was very, very tired, sitting beside this little Loch Esk, just outside Donegal town, and I was just so tired that I just wanted to die, really, to read the paper and die. And it's not too bad, actually. It was a very luxurious hotel that we were in by the Loch side, so it was a pleasant place to die. But nevertheless, just that sense of exhaustion was very real. Mm. And so that's where that came from. But it's quite near Glencolumbkill. That's another of the Gaeltacht areas of Donegal. Mm-hmm. And part of the poem, at least, is about the kind of language I would have spoke had my ancestors not come here.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, I think one of the earlier titles for the sequence, or one of the working titles, was poems for a now abandoned language.
Yes, yes.
Or poems to be translated into an abandoned language.
Yes, poems written for translation into an abandoned language. I've forgotten the Irish for it, but I could find it and let you know. It's poems, yes.
But that struck me as an interesting and curious title, because it immediately assumes a sense of distance from the language that you're writing in, that it's not an end product, that it's a process to be translated.
Yes, yes. And this was one of my earlier attempts, probably about maybe 4 years, maybe 5 years ago, to come to terms with Gaelic writing or Gaelic writing, because I was really aware that I was kind of attracted to Gaelic writing, but I didn't know very much Gaelic. And I would always gaze at it, and then I would go straight to the translation. The Gaelic's usually on the left-hand page, the translation's on the right, and I would read the translation and gaze at the other, and this was a kind of foreign language. So I thought I would try to write poems out of that sort of consciousness, kind of in translatorese language. Mm. What's nice about translations is the kind of slightly tangential view that they have of reality, and the grip on language is often not quite as firm as it should be, but the consciousness, the kind of foreignness, tends to come across, and there's often a kind of ungainliness or strangeness. And so I thought I would write poems in English directly to be translated back. It was the kind of a Gaelic version of English, as it were, our Gaelic take on the world. And it was me, as I imagined, poems that I imagined I would write had I'd never come here and had it grown up as bilingual.
So in Irish Gaelic.
I wasn't at the time, but Roddy Gorman took them, and he's trilingual. He writes in Scots Gaelic sometimes and Irish Gaelic other times, and he translated them straight away into Irish Gaelic, which really I found very touching and strange. And I've made attempts since to learn a little bit more of Irish Gaelic.
So can you tell me a little bit more about that partnership? Because did you have actually much input into the Irish version, or the Gaelic versions? No,
nothing, because my own Gaelic is so absolutely limited. Mm-hmm. He thinks I know more of it than I do, but I don't. No, I just met him somewhere and told him what I was doing, and he thought he would quite like to try translating them back, and I was delighted at that. Mm. And he put work in, and I haven't really done much since. They have been published, and people found them attractive. They've been published separately. Of them had been published separately. They weren't written for this. They were written as a separate sequence of about, there's probably about 10 or 15 poems at that time. I read one section of about 8, and then 8 or 9 poems. And then a second follow-up one, sort of about four or five poems.
Mm.
So I don't think we're quite as good. But they have, most of them have actually been published here and there separately.
That's interesting, because you do incorporate some of these back into the sequence.
Yes,
don't
I do.
Yeah.
I do, because they were part of that coming to terms with this cultural dimension of my life. You see, I'm very, very struck by the way in which people from my background, although mine is mixed Scots and Irish, and that's a very typical mixture within Scotland, the west of Scotland. My great-grandfather came over here probably in about the 1870s to work in industrial Lanarkshire at in ironstone foundries work, and from there to coal mining and different things like that. So these people have been here for over 100 years and longer in some cases. You could track back some of them actually, back to the 1850s. A Campbell who was a smith. And he was over here working, staying with his daughter, I think. And Catholic Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
And this sense that people could have been in Scotland for 150 years,
mm-hmm.
and I still feel actually different from a lot of what is the known ideology of Scotland. I don't
mm-hmm.
think like a Scot. I don't necessarily have the same sort of values. Part of me does, because my mother came from that Presbyterian Protestant work ethic background, although she became a Catholic, so there was some kind of spiritual dimension to her, but basically she has a strong work ethic, a driving force, and so I understand that part of Scottish identity.
Mm.
But part of me, works towards that identity. I work tremendously hard at things, I think. But another part of me realises there's a difference there, a difference in the way I speak, difference in the way I think. It's partly religious background and the cultural set of references that you get from that, which are hugely different, I think, from the norm. So part of the poem is an attempt to come to terms with these different ways of thinking, this different aspects of this cultural heritage, and this sense of searching for what I might otherwise have been, had not my people become Scottish, was part of this. And so this sense of personal exploration was mirrored by a linguistic exploration, not just of English, Scots and Irish, or English, Scots and Gaelic or Celtic, but also the other foreign languages which I had learned at school, large number of these, as I could in those days, by dropping science and maths and so on.
Because there are embedded into the sequence translations from other writers as well.
Yes, and little references and ways of using foreign language in that way.
Don't you think it's a kind of paradox in a way that in a very personal exploration of your own identity and your family history, you're actually using effectively a kind of gestalt series of voices that in order to explore language, you're collaborating with a translator who's then bringing the language back to the poem. What do you see the status of the English and the Gaelic versions?
Of the poems written for translation
yeah.
into an abandoned language.
I mean, which for you now is primary, or is that a daft question?
I would say that at an artistic level, the English version was primary in the sense that what I was trying to get was a way of describing, a way of looking at the world.
Mm-hmm.
But that was partly a manufactured way
mm-hmm.
of looking at the world. The fact that it then became an Irish poem delighted me tremendously, because that seemed to give a kind of validation or an authenticity to this first glancing experimentation as to whether I could actually construct that.
Yeah.
And I had to trust Roddy that he got it right.
Mm-hmm.
What is one of the funny things about it is that I learned why Irish had been abandoned, because it takes twice as long to say the same line. The length of each line is about twice as long in the Irish as
it is. I think we all knew that joke.
Well, I didn't know so much until I saw the two things side by side. Yeah. There's also, there's partly a little religious or cultural reference there, because Scotland within the Dominican Order is called Provincia Deserta, an abandoned province.
Yeah.
There used to be a Scottish province of the Dominicans, which is actually radically different and in a way more Protestant than the English Dominicans.
Yeah.
That's to say that they went back to the original premises of the order and so on, and the going for poverty and hard work, the way that the Dutch Dominicans did as well, for the soft English province allowed themselves to earn extra money and so on, and they only worked to their own priory. The Scots were much more radical, and they went back to the origins of the order and so on. And they were the ones that were first attacked at Perth by John Knox's mob. So that suggests that there was some kind of force that he recognised that had to be pushed aside. But anyway, Scotland then became an abandoned province. Now, an abandoned language suggests to me a kind of, something deserted, something of a loss.
Mm-hmm.
A cultural loss,
mm-hmm.
perhaps personal, but also I think in a way to Scotland, and certainly to the individuals concerned. These first people who were translated in that other sense, carried across the water, and having to lose contact with family and so on, although there was a fair bit of to and fro because the ferries were going every day and twice a day, so there wasn't it wasn't impossible, but it was very easy to lose touch with who you were because you had to merge, and one of the ways that you do that is you abandon whole aspects of yourself which are carried in the language and the way of understanding. And I do think that the way that you use language shapes the way that you think about things, and there are aspects of my language I think which are still quite Irish in a way. I don't know where I got that, but this inability to be simple, or inability to say yes or no, this notion of the Irish for no, there is no Irish for no, they don't have, they just say it is not, or something.
Yes.
So I'm very, very tentative in my language, and kind of fluidity is maybe something there. I don't know whether it is or not, but I often wonder what there was about it. I grew up in Dumfriesshire, speaking presumably the language of the playground, rural Scots. And whenever we came up to visit my grandmother, who was still in this same miners, essentially mining community, and listened to her and presumably my father speaking this Lanarkshire Scots, which I think was kind of Irish inflected, certainly in a way of expressing oneself. I was very conscious of the difference there, very conscious of the linguistic difference, of not just of sound but of ways of putting words in order. Just one wee bit which I'm aware of it is where it's the grandfather's voice, the one who was killed in the pit accident in about 1931 or 32, and he talks about his own back. He was a big man, and in this accident, the long back twisted out of a line utterly. The long back twisted out of a line utterly. Now, it's the placing of the utterly. I remember my grandmother eating ice cream once from the van which came round, and saying, "I shall be fat as a fool directly. I shall be fat as a fool directly." And it's the use of shall, and it's I shall be, which I think is old
Scots.
I shall be, but fat as a fool, meaning as a Down syndrome person, I think, the village fool. I shall be fat as a fool directly. That word directly, and the placing of it, that seems to me to be different from anything I've ever heard elsewhere. I don't think it's quite Scots. But anyway, I was trying to echo some of that Sorry. Little thing. But I don't want to be sentimental about this, but I've heard people say that, for example, Cote Bridge speech is recognisably different. I don't know if anybody studied it linguistically, but is recognisably different from Airdrie speech along these kind of religious division lines.
Yeah.
The guy who said that was that awful wild man of Scottish Scottish literature. Sorry, I've forgotten his name.
That narrows it down.
Yes. His name will come back to me. I should have brought along Across the Water because he's in that, and it's there that he, it's there that he talks about that. He's the one who's Des Dillon.
Oh, Des Dillon is his name. Okay. Yeah.
Who's a wild man and now living down in Wigtonshire, I suppose, getting his dose of Dumfries and Galloway Scots.
Yeah.
But anyway, he talks about that and ways of expressing yourself, which probably come from that sort of cultural background.
Again, when I was reading it, and this is partly because of my poverty of references, I mean, I was very struck by, simply because it's in the Four Compass Points.
Yes.
It reminded me of a lot of things like the Four Quartets, the Quaker Graveyard at Nantucket, and in the sense of there's a kind of pilgrimage there as well as a transition.
Yes.
It's a very, very spiritual sequence in many ways. There are direct references, obviously, to God and kind of echoes of Gerard Manley Hopkins and people like that.
Yes. Didn't know that?
I think so, in terms of some of the rhymes and the rhythms. I know that, again, it's privileged knowledge. I know you've been kind of translating Gerard Manley Hopkins into Scots. But these are not things that you were aware of. If you're reacting with surprise to them.
Not in particular. But yes, there may be. Certainly, in terms of the structure, I knew that a long poem had to have a structure. And I knew that the best structure was a kind of voyage or epic voyage, and this was the voyage of which I am one result.
Mm-hmm.
A voyage which has never been documented because the people were often came over here illiterate into a highly literate, at least ideologically literate, Scottish culture, the school in every parish and so on, as the, you know, the mark of the Reformation, the idea that you've got to be literate to read the Bible so you can interpret it according to your own sense of your own lights and that sort of thing. The Irish didn't come out of that background at all. That voyage was never documented. When they came here, they were so busy working that there was no time for the sort of writing that I was, the sort of writing that I am able to do because of the benefits of education and background. So in one sense, very strongly, I was speaking for the tribe, like the epic poet, trying to tell the story of this tribe of folk who'd come over often into an inchoate and painful experience of deracination and foreignness of culture, bigotry, poverty, being pushed around. On the other hand, it was better to do that with food in your stomach than to be pushed around elsewhere in Ireland. You know what I mean? So I'm not saying that they got nothing from here. They got everything from here, their life and so on, a means of earning it. But their voyage was never told. And so I had this tremendous sense of actually trying honestly to tell not just a family story, but a story that had never really been documented, not in this way. It's beginning to be documented historically, obviously, but just in some sense that encapsulates through the rhythms and sound something of the authenticity of that experience. And loss of language was part of it, but gaining language was part of it as well, gaining aspects of Scots, gaining aspects of culture, gaining a sense of being able to be more mobile, really, within that, upwardly mobile and sideways mobile. So I'd also, as you probably know, for my own doctoral studies, had looked at the structure of the English modernist long poem, particularly Basil Bunting's poetry. So I knew a fair bit about what the poem should kind of look like, and so the structures were there, which I then filled in with various bits of infilling, and some newly written and newly invented, and others coming out of that experience of personal and also artistic growth, which I had been engaged in for, you know, probably the last 10 years or so, last decade of my life. Yes, there's no. It's not surprising then that it's got those resonances. Interestingly, Basil Bunting was a Quaker as well.
Yeah, I was interested in the Gerard Manley Hopkins because there's obviously another kind of line of a kind of bloodline there, insofar as Hopkins was a Jesuit in Glasgow. Edwin Morgan has written a sonnet about Manley Hopkins in Glasgow.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you sometimes get in Manley Hopkins is an assertion of spirituality against a background of in kind of terrible circumstances, and things like the Wreck of the Deutschland, for example.
Yes.
And I wondered if that was. I mean, there is a very strong assertion of spirituality amidst the hardships that is going on here.
Yes. That's true. And Hopkins, of course, couldn't handle the Irish at all. certainly in Liverpool. The Glasgow ones were better. I think he got on better with the Donegal people because they seemed to have a wee bit more respect for him. Yes, there is a spiritual language. I was trying to count up the languages, and you know, there seemed to be nine or ten or so. But then you could add this one. The language that angels speak, which is the language that ash trees speak in a breeze. So what is angelic language like, and also what is e-language like? There's reference at the end to swallows in the sky typing emails to heaven.
A bit of text at the beginning as well.
Yes, in order to get that sense of narrowness. Yes,
and then
that's right.
And then stretching.
Stretching it out. Mm-hmm. Yes, all sorts of tricks there. Yes, the Hopkins thing is interesting. People are in Scotland now still interested in what's called Celtic spirituality, because the official religions on offer, both Protestant and Catholic, are open to severe criticism. By anybody looking at them, from the outside. In terms of their ability to be meaningful religions to people, and the sense of young people, you know, but still having some sense of, you know, spiritual dimension to life, the Irish in Scotland were often quite radical about the church that was on offer. Actually, there was this sense of Irish piety, the importance of the spiritual life of the world of nature, very, very ancient and Celtic, of holy places that you go to. The rosary is mentioned. The sense of prayer as aligning you with both heaven and earth, the holiness within the landscape. Which is there in holy places, the idea of going on pilgrimage, the very interesting, I think, passage north to Armagh, which goes through County Down, through Downpatrick and St Patrick there and so on. These things do speak a sort of spiritual language. I hadn't thought of Jeremiah Hopkins within that, because partly, I think, because he was a convert, and it always seems to me that the Jesuit spirituality was kind of the wrong one for him. He should have been should have entered another order, but he constantly chose the hard route, hardest route that he could possibly have taken. But maybe it is there. Maybe the resonances are there.
I can tell you the lines. Passages on page 12. What drives us, work does not sleep or sleep, but gouges out a course like water, and soon as endless as the air we gulp, midnight or noon.
Oh yes, I see what you mean.
It's a bit like, it's got the rhythms of the world, it's charged with the grandeur of God. It's got those kind of assonances. And also the kind of the delight in sound, I think, is there.
Yes.
But also that kind of questioning about the meaning of experience, I think we find in Hopkins, you know, looking actively for God, evidence of God in the natural world and in various kind of natural processes.
Yes. Yes, that could well be right. Part of the consciousness which is speaking in that first section, Passage East, is this priest, James Quigley, who may be an ancestral presence on my wife's side, and who's the last Catholic priest to be hanged in England, hanged in Kent.
So far.
Yes, I might bring back the death penalty just especially. So he was an interesting man, part of the United Irishmen movement, and you know that it starts with the escape and disappearance into Scotland of some of the survivors of the United Irishmen rebellion of 1798. James Quigley was making his way to Paris in order to try to enlist the help of French revolutionaries. He was caught with another quite well-connected aristocrat, but James Quigley took the rap for it. The other guy got away with it, and I think documents were planted on him. There's no doubt that he was going to Paris to get French revolutionary help for the United Irishmen Rebellion, but the United Irishmen became the United Scotsmen. They got involved in early radical movements in Scotland to try to get the votes and trade unions and all of that kind of business. So the idea of if there's a priestly presence, it's a radical priest, more radical than Hopkins was, who was a very middle class person, and that priest, because of his links there, was actually speaking out for much more of a dialogue and understanding between religions and against sectarianism. You know, the brotherhood of affection, a union of sentiment. These are the great, radical expressions of brotherhood and so on. The United Irishmen was the only time when for a fortnight Catholics and Protestants were fighting on the same side in Northern Ireland before the British government played the orange card and used the orange movement to break it up, and it fragmented. James Quigley, a remarkable man, very, very good writer and very learned and so on, very badly treated, his own family badly treated by the Orangemen in Armagh. But then, anyway, that's by the by, that there is that sense that if there's a spiritual guy looking at it, he's also a political guy. And he's the one, I think, that's looking out and watching, thinking about the angels and so on as he moves. But he's also speaking about people under, just for understanding and not for that, confrontation. How ignorant then, or how wicked must that man be who attempts through interested motives to make us enemies for religion's sake? Those are his words. They're not my words. Just as you have the Scottish politician, again I've forgotten his name, I would need to check it up, about saying we still have swarms from Ireland but have sent back as many, indeed more persons than in strict law we are authorised to do, but we must not stop at trifles. This was the Lord, who was the equivalent of the Scottish Secretary at the time, writing to London, running his groups of spies, not able to track down who were these rebels coming in, because they didn't carry passports, and they might be looking for work and so on. So you're getting all sorts of people coming across, and this was, of course, 1798. This is, people think that people were just coming because of the famine, and they were just coming hungry. They were coming for other reasons, and helping to change the face of Scotland, industrially, technologically, but also I would hope in offering something which was part of Scottish radicalism, and wasn't something piously different or actually suspect for those reasons, those misunderstood reasons, to the Scottish religious culture of the time.
We're going to have to call a halt there. That was really interesting. So
we'll just okay.